This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Go free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Over the past seven decades, the U.S. stock market has returned, on average, about 10% annually, a result that has, over this time frame, made it the most reliable return on investment capital of all major asset classes. 10% over a long haul, therefore, stands as the bogey to beat. If you've got a better investment to go for seven decades, year in and year out, make it. In the past few months, articles, people, and events, all related to a burgeoning movement in favor of early childhood education, have been reaching my attention, all claiming and some even demonstrating that extraordinary results can be gained for relatively modest investments. By placing a child age 3 to 4 in a well-designed learning environment, significant positive results can be achieved, and moreover, negative results later in life avoided. As the father of a child of 2 small children, I have come to see how a child's behaviors and attachments are formed from the moment of birth, and therefore how crucial those early years really are. The pre-kindergarten movement is now being heard. I sat in a luncheon recently here in Houston where a full auditorium of teachers, administrators, politicians, business people, and philanthropists listened to presentations on the issue. While many questions exist around program design and funding, this is an issue that crosses many boundaries and differences between people. Of all of the forms of capital, there may be perhaps none as powerful as that which we build in our children. And if the returns are as strong as they seem to be, we cannot afford the opportunity cost of failing to make the investment. On today's New Capital Show, we look at the case for early childhood education. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment.
Of a place and time where nobody gets annoyed. But I must admit, I'm not there yet. But something's keeping me going. Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Open up a world and let me in. Then there'll be a new to begin. I have dreamt of an open world, borderless and wide, where the people move from place to place and nobody's taking sides.
Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Open up a world and let me in. Then there'll be a new life to begin. I've been waiting for that moment to arise. All at once, the palace of peace will fill my eyes. How nice.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Coming up just a little bit later on the show will be Dr. Susan Landry of the Children's Learning Institute here in Texas and Professor David Kerp at the University of California in Berkeley. We will indeed be talking about early childhood education. Before we get to those two, though, I wanted to just bring a couple of news items to your attention. I saw a fascinating movie here in Houston that's been making the rounds around the country called The Rape of Europa. It's a movie about the Nazis purloining and looting of art treasures from all around Europe during the Second World War, and the effort that was made to return those to their rightful places. Oftentimes this was done by a group called the Monument Men, a group of U.S. soldiers, oftentimes led by professors of art history who were enlisted into service. And their heroic efforts and the heroic efforts of others to restore the looting that had taken place by the Nazis during the Second World War. The movie is going to show again this weekend at the Museum of Fine Arts. It was packed when I saw it last weekend. If you're interested in going, you should probably get tickets. And this was off the news just yesterday. December 12th from New York Times, rare look inside the Baghdad Museum. This is Kara Buckley of the New York Times. For a few brief hours today, three dozen spectators gathered at the National Museum of Iraq here in Baghdad, their voices echoing through its vast darkened halls. It was one of the few times outsiders have been allowed even inside the museum since Baghdad fell. Looters stripped the galleries of some 15,000 Mesopotamian artifacts, and the museum became a wrenching symbol of the losses of the war. Aside from a brief opening in late 2003 when officials and other guests were invited in, the museum has been shuttered since the invasion. But there has been a great push to reopen the museum of late. Its directors have managed to recover 4,000 missing pieces, among them some gems, Islamic coins, and carved stones. You may remember the launch of the U.S. invasion that the United States Army failed to provide any security whatsoever to a museum that houses some of the world's great antiquities. I think if you go see this museum again, The Rape of Europa, showing at the Museum of Fine Arts, I think it's Saturday and Sunday, 7 p.m. or so, but go ahead and go to their website. You will see that, in fact, very detailed plans were made by the United States Army back during the Second World War. Dwight Eisenhower, the general during the invasion of Europe, himself issued orders that soldiers were not to billet, were not to overnight in museums, and were to take careful, as great care as they could, of the monuments of Europe. In total contrast to the way that the Bush administration went to war in Iraq, where there was no thought whatsoever given to the care for the artifacts there. Just tells you how far we've come, or how far we've not come. This is just off the press this morning. Climate report confirms fears as talks stall. Again, the United Nations has released fresh data confirming that what it calls the planet's continued alarming rise in temperature is going on in our time. The 10 years ending in 2007 were the warmest on record, said Michel Giraud, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, a United Nations agency. He told reporters, it's very likely the warmest period for at least the last 1,000 to 1,300 years. That's amazing, folks. The warmest period on Earth for the last millennium, 1,300 years. And we know this from the core samples that they take from ice and all sorts of scientific techniques that we have now to look back at the climate. In the meantime, what we've learned, of course, is that the United States continues to refuse to make any kind of binding commitment whatsoever to limiting its emissions. And in the wake of that, China does too. We have the world's most populous nation and what has become the world's most polluting nation, China. And, of course, what has been the world's most polluting nation and what is still the world's wealthiest nation in terms of per capita income, the two of those nations refusing to go along and commit themselves under their current leaderships to helping the world out of this problem. As I tell, as you know, and as I say all the time, we have an election coming up, and it's time to get active. We need to choose people who are going to help us solve this problem, and I think everyday people are coming to that realization. A couple of other news items. President Bush is going to veto the Children's Health Bill on December 12, 2007. Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times writes that the White House said yesterday, that President Bush would veto a children's health insurance measure by the end of the day. Of course, this is now the second time that he has vetoed a children's health bill. This is the so-called S-CHIP program. Whenever he vetoes these, this is now the second one. Whenever he vetoes these things, he does it at the end of the day, in private, where nobody can see him do it. And, of course, no big veto ceremony going on with the president as he vetoes, again, a program to extend health coverage to lower-income children from lower-income families. His veto would effectively kill Democratic hopes of expanding a popular government program aimed at providing insurance to youngsters in lower-income and middle-income families. The veto will be the seventh of Mr. Bush's presidency. Of course, there were hardly any in the first term, and up through 2006, when the president had a Republican Congress with him. He's now had several. And again, this is the second of the children's health bills that he is going to veto. The veto continues the president's increasingly contentious battle with congressional Democrats over spending. And politically, what we're seeing, of course, is a lead up to the election. And this country will be able to choose which direction it wants to go. I think, hopefully, at the very least, we're getting a clear choice between two different ways of going about it. Finally, Fed cuts the discount rate a quarter point and stocks dive. This is from a few days ago. Stocks have bounced around since then. The Federal Reserve cut a key short-term interest rate today by a quarter of a percentage point to 4.25%, signaling its concern that the credit crisis might be gradually damaging the broader economy beyond housing. And, of course, you go on and you hear all the time talk of recession. You know, we're not going to have any growth, or the economy's not going to grow 3%, it's going to grow at 0.5% or 1%. I want to remind all of you out there, when you hear this, you've got to listen to the news in a particular way. When you hear we're going into recession, or you hear that there's not going to be any growth, okay, it doesn't mean that the economy is going to shut off and come to a standstill and that's it, okay? Let's be clear about this. It means that the $12 trillion of goods and services that get exchanged in our economy, it's not going to go to 12 trillion 100 billion next year. It's going to stick at 12 trillion. And our problems in terms of environmental destruction and the way that we use that GDP and GNP is still going to be there. Okay? So it's not like the world is coming to an end when you hear that there's a recession. We are still transacting vast amounts of goods and services. We are still taking huge impacts on natural resources. And as this show advocates all the time, we do not know and we do not calculate the full effect of all of our economic activities. We don't do it. We don't calculate especially our effects on natural resources, on natural capital, and very often on social capital and social justice. We don't calculate the effects of our economic activities. So the $12 trillion in gross domestic product that we transact and that we will transact even if we're in a recession, even that number is low in terms of the true value of our economic impact. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be joined by two experts who will be helping us understand what is the early childhood education movement that is going on. This is Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment.
There's a man with a gun over there.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. www.newcapitalshow is our website, and you can send me email there and sign up for our mailing list, whatever you would like to do. You can also get rebroadcasts of our past shows, and you can also join forums there and make any comments with others that you would like to do. I'd like to welcome here in the studio with me is Dr. Susan Landry. She is the director of the Children's Learning Institute here in Houston and also the director of the Texas State Center for Early Childhood Development. And joining us on the line from California is Professor David Kerp, who is with the University of California, Berkeley, the Goldman School of Public Policy, and the author of, I think it's a new book, this is called The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement and Kids First Politics. Dr. Kerp, Professor Kerp, are you with us?
I am, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on the New Capital Show today. Let's first start with you. I gave in my introduction a brief overview of the idea of the early childhood education idea, but help us understand it a little more. It's specifically for children ages 3 to 4, and it's a pre-kindergarten type of program. Is that right?
That's right, and it's a very important program in Texas as elsewhere in the country. It really represents the culmination of a perfect storm of research, all of which points to the importance of early education and the development of young kids.
Now, when you say a perfect storm, you're referring to different areas of academic inquiry that are showing benefits for this type of program.
That's right. I mean, the most intriguing study to me is one that's been going on for 40 years, beginning with 120 kids who went to a preschool in Ypsilanti, Michigan in 1963, and now they've been tracked all that time, and those kids, as compared to those who didn't have that experience, have led entirely different lives, both in terms of the amount of schooling they completed, staying out of prison, staying off welfare, and making on average about 25% more than those that didn't have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Dr. Susan Landry. Dr. Landry, first of all, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you.
One of the areas where we're learning things is in the area of childhood psychology and neurology. What are the findings that we are learning about the science of how a child's brain is formed and why it's so crucial to have some type of educational program in these early years?
Well, we're learning quite a bit. We're learning that we know now that children's exposure to language, to activities in those first years of life are actually forming the structure of their brains. It's becoming very well known that the physiology of the brain changes dependent on the kind of stimulation the young child gets.
But, I mean, it seems so basic to me now that I'm a father, and I'm a recent father, and I see clearly that, and we've always known that the brain of a human being forms, you know, maybe more rapidly. I don't know if that's the case in these early years. Why has it taken us so long to say, okay, we recognize that, and we need to create some kind of formal program that helps children during these years?
Well, I think many people have always known this, and we have had this early childhood movement for a number of years. The Head Start program started back in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
and specifically to give proper stimulation and learning activities to low-income children. But I think the science that's occurred over the last decade plus that looks at the actual physiology of the brain, which we couldn't look at before because we didn't have the techniques, really has allowed the vast majority of people in our country to understand it in a much more powerful, significant way.
So are you saying that, you know, we have electrodes now that are attached to children's brains, and we're now seeing some sort of extraordinary picture of the linking of synapses and neurons and so forth in children's brains, and we're saying, uh-oh, if we don't have a programmatic system of education around the formation of those brains, then we've got a problem.
Yes, I am saying that we don't have those electrodes on kids' brains in their classrooms, but in these scientific studies that are done on animals first and then with children, we are literally able to document visually how the brain looks different if the child has good stimulation. Mm-hmm. A lot of language input, a lot of exposure to cognitive and social concepts in the world than for children that don't have that.
I mean, you'll remember back maybe 10 years ago, those first images. You watch the brain literally as it's thinking and feeling. And I think those images had a punch for parents and for others that was almost equivalent to the first shots of the moon. You add that to the recent studies, which the economists are calibrating that something between 7 to 1 and 17% one, 7 to 1 and 17 to 1 of the return on social investment in preschool, and you appeal to both the pocketbook side of folks and the scientist side of folks, and just the we want to do right for our kids side of people. And as Susan was saying a minute ago, Head Start has been around for a good long time. It's reached a fair number, but hardly all those kids who are eligible. And of course, very well-off parents have known for years that it's great to have their kids in stimulating environments. They sent them off to nursery schools. They had
Professor Kurt Mike
to this. But it's the middle class that's now really pushing for this program.
And the poor as well. What's available for the poor?
Well, what is available for the poor is Head Start, but because the Head Start program has always been underfunded, fewer than half of the very poor people in this country have ever been eligible to send their kids to preschool.
Well, what does that program cost our country a year, the Head Start, if you know that number?
It's about $7 billion a year.
$7 billion a year.
It costs about $6,000 or $7,000 a child to provide a good Head Start program. And even there, the concern is that the teachers don't have the kind of training that we know is really helpful to improve the experiences of kids. Mm-hmm. The programs are often half-day, not full-day programs. And as I said, they're limited to the poorest of the poor. You basically have to be at or below the poverty line, which is really scraping by to have access to those kinds of programs.
Now, in Texas, there's also, beyond Head Start, there's quite a bit of funding for public state pre-K in the public school districts or through the public school districts. So that's not typical in all states. It is for the low income most often.
And I think you want to, Susan may be too modest to say this, but Susan's own role in this is really important in expanding pre-K in Texas.
We're also really looking to the child care facilities in Texas to help out with this effort. And they have not been recognized nationally or in our state until more recently as another wonderful opportunity for building our pre-K capacity. And what they need is more funding and more resources in terms of professional development and real strong curricula and resources in terms of materials for children to give a quality pre-K program. But they are another group of very well-intended providers of programs for children in this age range that we can bring into the movement.
Yeah,
that's a really important point to underscore, because nobody around the country is saying every parent must send their kid, their 3 or 4 year old kid to a public run preschool program. If I had my druthers, you walked into a classroom and you saw really good teachers, really engaging and exciting activities with kids, and the numbers were right so that you had no more than 18 or 20 kids and a couple of adults in a classroom, and parents were involved. If I saw that, I wouldn't care what the sign was on the door, whether it was a public school or a child care center or a nonprofit provider or a church basement or a for-profit provider. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't matter. What matters is the quality of what's going on inside that classroom, the experience for those kids.
Dr. Susan Landry, my daughter, I think from a fairly early age, a year and a half maybe she was, we entered her into a program at a local synagogue. And she goes for, it's a half day. And I heard Professor Kerr prefer to half days or whole days. She then comes home and, is that early childhood education that she's going through? She's getting 3 or 4 hours a day of...
Absolutely.
Of
that's early childhood education. And for that age child, probably, ideally, a half day is better because she's so young.
She takes a nap in the afternoon.
And she has time with her family in the afternoon. And nobody is... necessarily promoting for all children a full-day program. I think what we're trying to do in... before I go on to what we're trying to do in Texas, is to emphasize that quality also needs to be in the programs for these younger children. Mm-hmm. The children that are in child care centers, like your young child, if we have quality, nurturing, responsive environments with book reading and playful learning activities, and we start in that first year of life and the children experience that all the way through their early childhood period, they're so ready for school, they're going to challenge their kindergarten teachers to keep up with them.
Now, what is it that that a schooling environment provides for a small child over a loving environment in the home? So if the child has stayed in the home and there's a stay-at-home parent who is helping raise the child, what does the schooling environment provide above that environment that you're finding is important?
I think it's really important not to make a sharp contrast and to set the home against the preschool. The primary educator is always going to be the parent, and that's the way it should be, both in terms of the time they spend and the energy that they put into the education of their child. And if a stay-at-home parent can provide the kind of intellectual stimulation and the kind of playful learning that a kid could have, then staying home for a good chunk of time makes considerable sense. But what they don't get is that kind of playing with others, that learning about sharing, about taking your turn, that worrying about emotional regulation, that sort of paying attention to putting away your toys and doing all those kinds of things that are also important, very important in the social and emotional development of kids. I mean, as well, there are kinds of intellectual activities, playful learning activities that are a whole lot better done in groups than in
right.
and individually. So
I mean,
the combination of a good at-home experience and a good preschool experience, that's the ideal. And the problem, as you know, is that the average parent, the average mom, whatever the family income, is going back to work before her infant is 6 months old. So that means something needs to happen. And as Susan was just saying a second ago, and let me underscore, something of quality needs to happen. Because if you just put kids in an environment where nothing interesting is going on, where you park them in front of the TV, that's not early education. That's a sham.
Yeah, I think David's making a very important point that absolutely the family is the critical piece in the child's life. They're the caregivers. They're the attachment figures. However, we do have many families where both parents or single parent families where they have to work.
Yeah.
And so at those very young ages, children need to be in very high-quality, nurturing environments. If the parent's not working, the home experience can be the very best thing for the child. But by the pre-K year, there are other very important social things that are happening for the child.
But is it okay for me to say that even though my wife does not work, she's at home, I do work, we have a loving family home, it's okay for me to say that I see that my daughter gets benefits from attending such a program that wouldn't be available had she stayed in the house? I mean, I see
Absolutely.
That she gets social interaction, she learns how to work out issues with other children. Just getting that even a three-hour break from the family and getting a different perspective seems to have benefits for her.
Yes, and she's in a very high-quality program, and that's what's key.
Mm-hmm.
She's in a program where the ratio of children to caregivers is appropriate. She's in a program where they're talking to her and reading to her and playing with her. So she has this rich experience for these few hours in the morning. It gives her a chance to be exposed to things she might not be exposed to if she was at home, particularly other kids.
If you're just joining us, I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. We're talking about early childhood development and early childhood education programs, which are gaining steam in the public consciousness. My guests are Dr. Susan Landry of the Children's Learning Institute, which is part of the University of Texas.
Yes.
And Professor David Kerp of the University of California, Berkeley, the Goldman School of Public Policy. Professor Kerp, what sort of money do we need to inject into this area to bring it up to what you would consider to be snuff?
Well, you know, when I roamed around the country, as I did in writing the Sandbox Investment, talking to legislators all over the place.
And tell us a bit about your book, too. You know, either now or in the context of another answer later, we'd like to hear about it too.
Well, I'm happy to do that, because I spent a fair amount of time crouching in the kinds of pre-K classrooms that Susan and I and you were talking about. Also, some classrooms that were so scary that I really was tempted to organize a rescue mission and grab those kids and run out into the playground and save them from what was going on in those places. So this is where my real concern about quality comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But let me respond to that question. It's going to cost $6,000 or $7,000 to provide a good pre-K education. Now, what that means, I mean, is that you really are. This is not a world in which if you invest a little, you get a little back. If you invest a lot, you get a lot back. As a report prepared for your legislature concluded, invest a little, you get nothing back. You really do have to make a commitment to the lives of these kids and all of the programs that have been demonstrated to work. And some of them in public schools, some of them in non-public school settings, some of them experimental, some of them, as in the program in Tulsa, Oklahoma, regular public-private school programs with ordinarily trained teachers. They're going to cost $6,000-$8,000 a year. Now, the monies that have been discussed on the campaign trail and every one of the Democratic candidates, and I'm actually surprised that not the Republican candidates yet have been talking about preschool. The monies on the table are sort of begin in the range of an additional $10 billion. Sounds like a large number.
No, it sounds like a small amount to me. I just
exactly.
paid bills.
No, we've gotten used to this, right? A billion here, a billion there.
I paid my bills before I came to the station today, and $10 billion looks pretty small compared to what my bills are running.
Exactly. So one of the things that people don't realize is when the economists talk about this is a great investment, this huge return on investment, what they're saying is that relative to the rest of us, and we're all, you know, to some extent getting on in years, so we think about the rest of us, kids are inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
It does not cost a ton of money to educate a child as opposed to taking care of a senior. And we don't need to choose between those two things. But we really need to realize that we have, as compared to any other industrialized country that I know about, we've been just shameful in the way in which we've neglected kids, not just in early
education. Dr. Landry, do you agree with that?
I agree totally.
Have we been shameful?
We have been shameful, and we need to put a lot more investment in our young children. Our child care programs need a lot more support to care for children. They are caring for often very low children from very low income backgrounds. The parents are trying hard to get into the workforce. They need to know their children are in environments that are nurturing and stimulating so that they can be comfortable when they're at work. Middle class or up and at least upper middle class families who are also struggling financially when they have to pay for child care at least often have some options given their financial situation. But very low income families often have very few options for where they can afford to put their children.
What do we have in Texas? Obviously that's the place, this is the place where you're doing your work and you have contacts in the state legislature, as well as in the programs themselves. How do we understand where funding for these programs and where development of the programs are here in Texas? So let's use Texas as a microcosm. Our show is heard across the country now through podcasts, but maybe you can help us understand what Texas looks like so other people might think about their states as well.
Well, our 3 and 4-year-old programs, the biggest amount of funding is from the state is into the public schools. But now that funding is being redirected to benefit both the public schools who are being encouraged to go into partnerships with the child care in their community and the Head Starts. We are looking at Texas to have a mixed delivery model where there's a seamless, integrated delivery of pre-K services and families get a choice. If they need an extended day because of their work schedule, there will be a child care in that community that has the same curriculum, a certified teacher, the teachers trained in the same strong, effective practices as the public school down the street that maybe only has a program that goes to 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
And yet there are complaints about public schools, and there are problems in public schools. So how do we address that issue, that the public schools themselves, though some are in shape to be able to deliver and to provide this administration and this service, others are not. How does that work?
Well, I think a big part of it has to do with we need more funding in general that will go both to the public schools and also from the public schools to the child care and Head Start programs to develop this mixed delivery. But the funding to be effective has to be very clearly allocated for the aspects of quality that we know are important. Good curriculum, professional development for our teachers. We've learned an incredible amount of new information about what 3- and 4-year-old children learn, can learn, and how they need to be exposed to it. And our teachers haven't always been trained in those techniques. And so some of that funding really needs to go, a lot of it, to support the teachers so they can get the proper skills and have the right resources in their classroom to get the job done. We also need to give parents more information and more opportunity to learn what's important for children.
And then I have one
Let me just underscore.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, David Kerr.
Texas is a good deal to teach the country. For one thing, Susan has developed a program. It's one of the only ones that I know in the country that really tries, and I think tries successfully, to expand the number of trained people working with kids. And that is so important. When I would watch pre-K classes, I would see small miracles going on every day. And I would think, you know, I'm a university professor. I have it so easy. I mean, there are no kids who are going to be, you know, scuffling with each other. Nobody's going to be, you know, bawling from mom. Nobody's going to have to run off to the bathroom every second. And to see in that environment where you also have kids who are just these amazing explorers, learning with the help of the teachers, just a mile a minute, it's exciting and extraordinary. And the work that Susan and others are doing in training teachers to take advantage of those situations to really work with the kids is remarkable. And the other thing I want to say is you have some of the sharpest political advocates in the country who've done an amazing job of expanding slowly but surely the pre-K program in the state. When last year, when, as I'm sure you'll recall, and I say all this because I spent a fair amount of time in Texas roaming the state and talking both to the politicians and looking at some of the programs. When you were trying, the state was trying desperately to figure out how it was going to pay for its programs, having engaged in a major tax cut, actually expanded the preschool program. And why? Because legislation now on the books says every kid whose mom or dad was a soldier who fought in Iraq, died in Iraq, or came home from Iraq, every one of those kids is entitled to state preschool. And now every foster kid is entitled to state preschool. Well, that's expanding the program bit by bit. And as both Susan and I have said, it really is shameful to see how, not in Texas, but across the country, we've shortchanged kids. I mean, it's a scandal from my point of view that every child does not have access.
Dr. Susan Landry, what is the political situation here in Texas? David Kerr has just said that you and others have been successful in chipping away at restrictions on who is qualifying for this type of program. We have two major political parties, Democratic and Republican. How does the political landscape lay out in terms of who is either most supportive or most creative or most willing? Is there a divide or is there a consensus that this is a good thing here in Texas?
Well, we are fortunate in having a lot of bipartisan support. Our governor has come out for early childhood as one of his major initiatives and has asked for more funding. That said, we have a long way to go. We did not make big gains in this past session. We had hoped to see much larger funding put towards this effort, and it didn't happen. We have major Democratic champions. Senator Judith Zaffarini in Laredo has championed bills that have moved this innovative mixed delivery model program forward over the last several sessions. On the Republican side, we also have champions. We need more champions. We need more legislators getting into that arena and making this a key issue. And they are saying they need to hear from their constituents. Mm-hmm. And so I think as this show is so important to get that message out to parents, because the legislators, of course, are going to listen to the families in their communities.
So somebody listening to the show today, what should they do? They should contact their state representative.
Yes.
And say what?
Say, I am learning a lot more about the importance of early childhood. I know some things are going on in the community, but I know that, for instance, we're not serving all the children. Where do you stand on this? I want to let you know where I stand.
David Kerr, at the who is joining us from Berkeley, California today. Where does the issue stand at the national level? Is it getting any visibility in the federal government? And if so, where are its pockets of support?
Well, across the states, it's one of the most interesting phenomena. You get Republicans and Democrats alike supporting preschool. Texas is one example. There are just dozens across the country. 30 governors last January mentioned expanding pre-K as part of their State of the State address. And so far, it's been a state-level program. But as I said earlier, every one of the Democratic candidates for president has made expanding preschool a part of his or her agenda. And I'm just waiting.
Every candidate. Every Democratic candidate.
There's no reason why this should be a Democratic issue. You think, for example, about Mike Huckabee and his social justice message. And the role that he played in Arkansas in expanding preschool. Arkansas is one of the great preschool states. This is one of those questions that oughtn't be a Democrat monopoly or a Republican's monopoly. This is about kids, and that's where the states have figured this out.
But Professor Kerb, how does a Republican plank of cutting taxes more, which they're continuing to discuss in their national presidential candidate debates, additional tax cuts? We're already running deficits. How can they come out and advocate a program that's going to cost more money in the face of these tax cuts? Are they not bumping up against inconsistency here?
Well, inconsistency has never bothered politicians in the past, and I'm not sure that it will in the present. But we're talking about, as we've said, relatively small investments, and we're talking about great returns on investment. That's the kind of language that ought to appeal to Republicans. When the Fed Reserve Chairman, when Ben Bernanke comes out for expanding early education, you know, when the business roundtable, all those Fortune 500 executives,
yep,
talk about expanding pre-K, when the police chiefs and the DAs and the sheriffs, an organization called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, when they come out for expanding preschool, there's so much political cover, if you please, or justification for a smart Republican to differentiate himself from the pack that, again, I'm just shocked that it hasn't happened. They really are missing an opportunity. Listening to the radio this morning, the voters in Iowa were saying, you know, these guys are saying the same old, same old. Well, this is one of those.
We're going to cut taxes. Messages. We're going to cut taxes. Taxes have already been cut, at least for the rich, in the past 10 years, as
yep,
Warren Buffett pointed out the other day.
And I do think in individual states, taking Texas, for example, when we can show the cost benefit to our legislators, when we can put in place, for instance, we've recently been following the children in this innovative program called the Texas Early Education Model into kindergarten. And we found that these children from low-income programs, from low-income families, are getting into kindergarten if they've had this quality program with reading and social screening scores that are comparable to middle and upper middle income kids. So we are actually closing the achievement gap so the child enters kindergarten ready. Then we can do cost analysis or cost benefit and savings that we can present to our legislators. I think we have to be very savvy in the way we try to convince people that this is a good investment. We have to demonstrate it. We have to show it's accountable.
Mm-hmm. We have to talk the language of capital and return.
Yes.
And,
have to talk lots of language.
Yeah.
This is, remember, the brain science language is really important, and also the fact that kids live better lives. And, you know, if they're actually in stabler families, less likely to be on welfare, working healthier.
Well, David Kerb, what
appeal as well?
What is at stake for society as a whole? I mean, you're starting to allude to these issues. I saw Professor James Heckman, who is I think he's still with the mm-hmm. Federal Reserve, and he's an economist, and he's doing interesting work in this area. He made a presentation here in Houston. He was talking about the fact that once you have to intervene with the child much later on in their educational history, it's almost too late, and the costs become, at that point, extraordinarily prohibitive. So what are the different angles at which this is a vital issue for society at large?
Well, I'd hate to think about giving up on anybody at any stage of life.
Cause, right.
As you and I know, we are still learning at tender ages.
Right. He didn't
say. But it clearly makes sense, as Jim Heckman, who actually is a professor at the University of Chicago and a Nobel Prize winner, by the way, as Jim Heckman and many others have pointed out, it's just a lot less expensive to invest early on. And just to dramatize the gap, there's a study that was done in which some researchers actually counted the number of words that children children heard, spoken by adults and others in the household. By the time they're 4 years old, children from professional households have heard 30 million more words than kids from welfare families. Those children have bigger vocabularies than the welfare moms do. So the gap that Susan is talking about closing is really huge, and the fact that those kids who've been through the TEAM program in Texas are going to kindergarten ready to learn is a remarkable accomplishment, and one that just cries out for magnification in Texas and elsewhere.
This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. My guests today are Dr. Susan Landry. She's the director of the Children's Learning Institute, part of the University of Texas. And she's also the director of the Texas State Center for Early Childhood Development. And joining us from California by phone, Professor David Kerp of the University of California at Berkeley. And we are talking about early childhood development. Dr. Susan Landry, we've heard both of you use the word quality, and the program has to be a well-designed program and a good program. It has to have good teachers. What are the elements, as you see it, what are the key elements that compose quality? When somebody looks at a program, what are the things that we use to evaluate whether that standard is being met?
It's a great question. People use the word quality, and it means many, many different things. I think we start to narrow down what it really means by examining what we put in place in the programs and whether it actually gets kids where they need to be. And for instance, we've recently found that some very key components, which are tested out in programs in four states and found to get the job done, are a very strong curriculum. So the teacher has something that she turns to every day, the books, the lesson plans, the materials, so she doesn't have to go home at night and run to the dollar store or to the library and gather up materials. She has what she needs in her classroom. Then, the second key component of the three is her training. She needs a lot of strong professional development, which ultimately we hope to get into the college programs for these teachers as they're trained.
Where they have a degree in education.
Yes.
Early childhood education,
and they know how to take advantage of teachable moments when the kids are playing on the playground. They talk to them. They point out things. They don't lose opportunities, and they learn how to make it playful, but planful and purposeful. We talk about the three P's. Planful, purposeful, but playful. That's so critical, and it's harder than making it rote and drill or making it completely child discovery. The teacher needs to take a very active, intentional role, but there's got to be this beautiful balance of being responsive to the children's needs, warm and sensitive, and also really giving them these engaging, exciting learning activities.
Professor Kerp, are we anywhere close to having the amount of teacher capital, the pool of teacher capital that we require to meet the type of experience that Dr. Landry has described?
I wish I could say yes, but again, we've so underinvested in early childhood education. This is the hardest and most important part of teaching that we do, and we pay these folks a whole lot less. The child care staff that Susan was talking about a few minutes ago, they make on average $8.50 an hour. Their turnover rate is higher than for any field except gas station attendants. And again, that's if we're going to not make an investment, we're not going to expect the kinds of results that Susan and I have been talking about. And if you're a parent, just one bit of advice as a way of turning the message that Susan is describing into something that you can actually use. Walk into a class and watch and see whether or not the teacher is actually engaging in conversations with the kids, not just talking at the kids, not letting the kids just wander off on their own, but talking to them. And then at the end of a class, you ask the teacher, so what were you trying to accomplish this morning? Going on here? Then you hope that the teacher has the kind of answer that would come from the immersion in a real curriculum that Susan has been describing.
A listener has called in and asks, why can we not produce a pre-K program for everybody instead of just people who are below the poverty level? Dr. Landry, this goes to the issue, I guess, of this mixed,
mixed delivery model. Right. Oh, we absolutely can. We know how to do the job for all income levels, but We need our legislators to know that the people in their communities want this to happen. They have to hear that they want the funding allocated for children across all income levels.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Kerp, what if we just sort of do a thought experiment and look at the model of taxation across the country at local, state, and federal levels? If we look at the degree to which programs in general across the country are underfunded, what would be a proper mechanism to fund these programs, in your opinion?
Well, let's start with the bright side. And the bright side is that in the last 2 years, taxpayers across the country have spent an additional $2 billion of their own dollars to provide preschool. Now, that may not sound like a ton of money, but it's the first big new social initiative that we've had in this country since the LBJ days.
And to put the $2 billion in perspective, we spend in Iraq probably $5 to $10 billion a month or something like this. Is that right?
Right. I mean, just imagine what we spend on Coke a day, you know, I mean, Coca-Cola. It's a tiny, tiny amount of money. But it is new money, and we're working our way down that path. I think the states are, in this area, always going to be taking the lead. Their numbers have been expanding. Their budgets have been expanding. But it's very important for the federal government to be a partner in this story. The Head Start program needs to be part of this enterprise. So does the child care field. So do the nonprofits. So do the for-profits. They all need to join hands and push together. And I would say to that caller, he's one of those folks who ought to be joining with other like-minded citizens and pushing, because politicians hear the good side of the news, but they also hear that if there are folks who are saying, you know, this is really important to me, and if you don't get on the bandwagon, we're going to find somebody else. And that's beginning to happen. When that happens, then politicians will pay it.
Dr. Landry, how are these different, in this mixed delivery model, how are the different participants and constituents, how are the different program leaders working together, meeting each other, and coming together to make this mixed delivery model, at least as it exists here in Texas?
Well, the Texas Education Agency has taken a lot of leadership.
So they're the umbrella that gathers everybody up and says, right, which children are being covered, which are not,
right.
Where do we have a gap, where are
they're
we?
Saying to us, the state center, we want you to get these guys to play together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go to the communities with the funding we are allocated, and we say, let us know if you want to be part of this type of program. What you have to do to be part of it is bring public school, child care, and Head Start into your partnerships, and you have to work together. And you have to come up with common standards, common goals. The school districts are allowed to put a state-funded 4-year degree teacher into child care facilities if the child care is serving state eligible children. So what we're trying to see, and many communities are stepping up to the plate, we have over 3,000 classrooms currently in this project in 38 communities. And so all of those 38 communities have this mixed delivery team partnership. Now the Texas Education Agency is saying to the school districts, go beyond this. There's almost $200 million every biennium for pre-K expansion. Make that money start working towards this kind of partner.
And are we paying teachers the $8.50 that Professor Kerp was
saying?
No,
our teachers are paying.
You're not paying the teachers, but you're paying your preschool workers that kind of money.
We're paying our child care, typically that kind of money, especially in low-income.
Where should it be? Where does it need to be?
Well, some of our teachers are, you know, starting in the 30,000 range, which is still low for the job they have to do.
Yeah.
And certainly the child care workers, who have a huge responsibility, need to be way beyond $8 an hour. Many of those child cares are dependent on federal funds from the child care block grants out of the Health and Human Service Department. That's where the federal government can play a much stronger role in bringing that. Most of our young children are taken care of in child care if they're not in the home. The public schools are serving 3 and 4s, but not all 3 and 4s, and not middle class and above.
Let me just say one more encouraging thing about Texas. When the Sandbox Investment, my new book, came out this fall, I visited Austin, and a meeting was organized with staffers in the legislature who are interested in this issue. And that room was packed. There were 40 or 50 folks there, from the education committees, the child services committees, the budget committees. So they're really, and they're there because their bosses are interested in what it is that's going on. So, you know, this is a state where there really has been, you know, slow and steady momentum. I agree with Susan that, you know, it's unfortunate that Texas isn't where everybody would hope it would be. But if you compare where the state is now to where it was 5 years ago, a lot of progress has been made.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. David Kerp, your new book, or just came out in the fall, The Sandbox Investment. It's out on, I think, Harvard University Press.
That's right.
Is what I saw. And people can pick it up, I guess, on Amazon.com. And
at a 30% discount.
Great. Will it be? I assume it'll be a good primer for helping people get oriented on this issue.
It's a good read. Mm-hmm. I mean, the deal that I make to folks is buy the book, and if you're bored, you know, sell it back to me. And send it back to me, and I'll give you your money back. Yeah. It really is meant to be not a kind of dry tome, but a kind of story-filled, interview-filled, as well as fact-filled book that sort of tells you what's been going on, why it matters, and where we might be going.
And Dr. Susan Landry, if people want to reach you and have further questions for you or how they can become involved, how can they do that?
They can reach me. I'm at the University of Texas Houston Health Science Center, and we have a wonderful web with lots of information, and it's the Children's Learning Institute .org. We have a new report we just put up yesterday on this state program and the results we've gotten from it in terms of changing teacher behavior and children's outcomes.
Well, great. We will post a link. Frankly, we'll post a link to both of you on our website later today at www.newcapitalshow.com. So if people want to reach you, they can do it through our website. We'll have a rebroadcast of the show. I want to thank both of you very much for being my guests today to talk about an incredibly important issue as it pertains to the development of capital in our society. Professor David Kerp of the University of California at Berkeley, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
It's been my pleasure.
And Dr. Susan Landry of the Children's Learning Institute here in Houston, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you here in the studio.
It's been great. Thanks.
We'll be back with you 1 week from today. Until then, take care.
George R. Brown Convention Center will host a very special event Saturday, December the 15th. The Calvin Owens Orchestra will feature vocalist Ray Brown Jr., the son of Ella Fitzgerald and legendary jazz bassist Ray Brown. This performance will be a special tribute to Houston's own Huey Long of the Ink Spots and Ella Fitzgerald, who worked with the Ink Spots. The event will be filmed in high definition for a documentary on Huey Long, a project on Ella Fitzgerald, and the Texas Roadhouse Live television series. Opening the show will be the Poncho Claus Big Band. This show is in conjunction with the week-long Poncho Claus Art and Entertainment Project, benefiting Latino youth at the George R. Brown. Dinner is provided with the show. For event information and tickets, you can call 936-443-6891.
This is KPFT Houston.
The Bush administration and its congressional allies are systematically trying to convince the American people that Iran is a clear and present threat to the United States. But as in the lead-up to the Iraq War, the administration has been using unreliable sources, exaggerated threat assessments, selective use of information, and questionable accusations about Iran's nuclear program. A United States strike on Iran would directly lead to the deaths of tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of Iranian men, women, and children. The Pacifica National.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.